Today I'm speaking with Christoph Koch, the Chief Scientific Officer at the Allen Institute. Christoph needs little introduction, as he has long been a prominent figure in theoretical, computational, and experimental neuroscience. He's also closely collaborated with famous scientists like Francis Crick, one of the co-discoverers of the structure of DNA. Today we discuss Christoph's views on the neural correlates of pain, suffering, and other morally urgent states of consciousness.
I always grew up with dogs from my early childhood, and I also grew up Roman Catholic, and I always believed that whatever we have, dogs also must have, because clearly they're gorgeous creatures and they're capable of a range of emotions, maybe not as deep as humans' emotions, but they are certainly capable of experiencing the world and suffering and enjoying them. And I was always extremely fond of dogs and still am. And when I had this German shepherd, a black German shepherd called Nosy, she was intensely curious. And when she passed at age 12, she died in my arms. And I was completely distraught that night as she was dying in my arms. And I cried and all of that. And then I thought to myself, how is it possible that I'm distraught about the death of my canine companion, yet I'm perfectly willing, and in fact, I enjoy eating the flesh the flesh of similar creatures like pigs and lambs and cows, cattle, etc., that are basically roughly as complex, and as capable of having a similar range of conscious experiences as my beloved dog. And so that night, many years ago, I resolved partly to honor Nosy, partly because I just felt it was the right thing to do, never to eat the flesh of another conscious creature again. And like many, I've always had the thought that it's probably not good to eat, for ethical reasons, to eat the flesh of conscious creatures, particularly when they are grown under atrocious condition, like in modern animal husbandry and slaughterhouses. But it's very difficult because the taste of flesh is deeply ingrained in our culture. It's very difficult to overcome that. So for me, it took this emotional trauma of my beloved dog dying to finally instantiate that decision, and I've stuck with it ever since.
Which animals do you think are conscious?
That's a good question. It depends on how you measure consciousness, of course. Now, if you look at the complexity of behavior, so typically we judge consciousness in others by their behavior, mostly by what they say. Now, that only applies, of course, to adult humans. So if I ask you and we're talking about some event in politics, or we're looking at the sunset and I ask you to describe the sunset and you roughly tell me what I see. Of course, never exactly the same, but you can tell me about your feelings about seeing the gorgeous sunset. Then I assume that you're conscious. Now, that's not true for all people. You may have had a stroke and you may become aphasic, but you still have complex behavior. And so I believe that you're still capable of conscious experience, although you cannot directly verbalize them. In pre-linguistic competent infants, very young children, I have a grandson now, he doesn't speak yet, yet I believe he has conscious experiences. And likewise with animals that are related to us. So mammals, they're all closely related to us, evolutionary, like dogs and cats and horses and elephants and whales, etc., etc. Their behavior is very complex. They're capable of planning. They have a range of ways to communicate with us, by their bark, their playful bark and aggressive bark, by the way their ears are pointed, the ways, the wag with their tail, the entire body. You can infer something about their emotional status. So most often we use behavior. Furthermore, now as neuroscientists, we know the brain's extremely similar, to the extent that if I am given a little grain of rice, piece of brain from a mouse, a dog, a monkey, a human, the elephant, a whale, etc., it's very difficult. Only an expert anatomist armed with a microscope can tell the difference between these species. So in fact, I tried this. So I'm the president of a big brain science institute of 300 people, and we study two species, human brain and mouse brain. And at one of our all staff meetings, I showed pictures of nerve cells that are either taken from a mouse or taken from a human brain, from a human neurosurgical tissue. And I showed 12 of them. And in each case, I asked people to guess using a phone applet whether they thought this was human and mouse. The only thing I did, I removed the scale bar. The human brain is thicker, roughly 3 times thicker than the mouse brain, so the size would give the species away. So I removed the scale bar from this image, and then people are essentially a chance. The basic hardware is very similar.
Right.
The basic hardware is very similar. We have bigger brains than mice, but of course other species like elephants and whales have even bigger brains. So by their behavior and by their brains, we know, you know, we're closely related. And of course also, you know, genetically, evolutionary, we know we're all closely related. You know, the last common ancestor of all of us placental mammals, you know, lived, you know, roughly 61 million years ago, just after the, you know, the asteroid came down and wiped out most life on Earth. So therefore, certainly mammals, I assume, take it as a given, and most biologists do that most mammals or all mammals are capable of experiencing the joys and pains and suffering of life. Now, each, of course, to his own. You know, I can think about myself, I can think about my weekend, I can project myself forward. My dog isn't able to do that, but my dog, you know, certainly can be upset and can be fearful and can be curious and can be sort of, you know, angry. Why only mammals? Probably not. There are many other complex creatures that have a different brain whose brain organization doesn't, for example, include a neocortex. Neocortex is called one of the hallmarks of the mammalian brain. You know, there are plenty of fish that show complex behavior, birds that show very complex behavior, invertebrates, right? Squid, octopus, even bees. I love bees. Bees have less than 1 million neurons compared to the 86 billion neurons of the human brain. So roughly 100,000 times fewer neurons. Yet bees have very complex behavior. They can do the waggle dance. They can return to a source of nectar. They can find it. They can communicate the source of nectar to their fellow sisters. They build complex social organization. They can recognize individual beekeepers, all in a tiny brain that had to be tiny because it has to be airborne. So I assume it probably feels like something to be a bee. Now, a bee doesn't have complex psychology. I don't believe for 1 second that the bee has, you know, feels fat or thinks about the weekend. But I do believe that the bee, when it's just, you know, just taking some golden nectar off a flower and flies back to its hive, it feels, you know, something akin, it feels good. It may feel something akin to happiness. It has some of the same hormones, you know, dopamine or octopamine, which is very similar to dopamine, and that we have. So we don't know exactly where the boundary is within the tree of life, but it's probably much larger than we usually think in Western canon, where consciousness is reserved either, you know, most people, many Christians, of course, believe only we are really conscious, or at best to a few sort of charismatic megafaunas, you know, our pets and wolves and orcas and blue whales and eagles, you know, some of those sort of famous and charismatic animals. But it's probably much more widespread than we think. And in fact, it may well be true that every animal, or possibly even every biological creature, every evolved creature may feel like something.
And specifically, do you think that insects in general can suffer, even if, because I could envision a creature that has experience, maybe without valence, but do insects suffer in general?
It's a very good question. So here I can tell you certain experimental facts. So for instance, you can... I know this for grasshopper because we used to work with locust. So you can operate on the back of a leg. You can, for example, cut it off, or you can insert an electrode in there. The insect will strike. You know, the leg will push against that. Right, it's a local circuit reflex. Yet the locust may perfectly well continue to feed. Okay. So if I'm cutting off your leg, or if I'm inserting something in your leg, like a big syringe, you're not going to go on eating, right? You will fight with me to try to prevent that. Now, insects, at least these insects don't seem to do that. So they don't seem to have a centralized representation of pain, that this is so bad, I have to turn my entire body, my entire focus towards fighting off this this major challenge. So that leaves the question open, is it just a local reflex? Okay, so if I try to cut off its legs, the local leg sort of has this sort of like a spinal cord reflex, or is it really something closer to us? That's difficult to say at this point in time. Do they tend to their wounds, just, you know?
We don't know if they're just pea zombies, little insect pea zombies.
That's correct. So in each case, one has to make sort of, you know, you have to really think about it carefully, and you have to look at the and the behavioral and the behavioral evidence.
Right. I mean, I don't know for sure that you're not just a figment of my imagination, but I can string together a series of good reasons based on that you report similar things about your emotional experience of the world. I can infer that animals do based on facial and other bodily reactions. But do you think that there's sort of a bigger reason to be skeptical that insects have suffering, that you couldn't apply that same skepticism to, say, mammals?
The skepticism, I simply don't buy. Yes, we all know that ultimately I can't even prove the external world exists, right? So, I mean, I can be a solipsist, nothing else exists. But if you want to, infer something about the world that's out there, I think a much more reasonable assumption is you try to explain the largest possible number of facts about what you observe with the fewest number of assumption, abduction. This process, logical inference process, right? And so therefore, I assume, I can observe other people and they have brains. I know this from my science. And animals have brains. And the behavior is similar to mine. I mean, it's not exactly the same, but it's similar to mine. So the supposition that they would have one type of brain that would follow one type of law, namely wouldn't generate consciousness, and I, for completely unclear reason, am the only creature in the universe that has a brain that generates consciousness. Yeah, I mean, logically, I can't exclude that, but it just seems, radical unlikely. And so what we do, except if you're a professional philosopher who has to write, a living, writing books and keeping people amused, each one of us in our practical life, of course, assumes that other people are conscious. Now, whether I'm willing to act on that, we all know, people can do horrible things to other people. They can lock them up and kill them in large numbers in concentration camps, et cetera, et cetera. But that sort of, despite knowing that these people are conscious, I'm still willing to do that for all sorts of reasons, because I think they're subhuman, or I hate them, or they've done me some wrong. But I simply don't find it very interesting, this skepticism. It's the same thing when you go on online, you find all these conspiracy. Being trusting everything is as bad an assumption as trusting nothing. In both cases, right. I don't think it leads to a really useful understanding of the world and how I should act in it, and how I should also manipulate it to the best of my abilities to maximize whatever goals I'd like to achieve.
Consequences of denying suffering in other creatures, even if they don't, is that you could be doing something horrific to another being. Whereas if you take a more cautious approach, you could potentially, and likely are, preventing quite a great deal of suffering.
To a small animal or to a person? To me, it's all closely related.
Yeah. So the reason it's closely related are these neural correlates of consciousness. But what are the neural correlates of suffering?
The reason it's related ultimately, I mean, Jake, it's I infer consciousness in others due to a combination of factors. The behavior is similar, although not identical. The underlying brain, the the brain that we believe is closely associated with consciousness or constitutes the physical substrate of consciousness is similar, and we're all genetically related. So for this abundance of evidence, I infer conscious sensation to a variable extent in other creatures. This includes the various aspects of conscious experience, including the ones with negative valence, you know, suffering, pain, over various time scales for various reasons, both physical suffering, because, you know, I have a wound, I've infected, I've suffered from COVID-19, I'm in pain, or because of not so much physical suffering, because directly a pain receptor is activated, but because I lost my mate, I feel meaningless, the meaninglessness of life is weighing me down. I am super anxious, right? So there are these different aspects of suffering, both direct physical suffering that in the modern world we have conquered to a certain extent because of medicine and the miracle of medicine, but then also, you know, psychological suffering that probably today constitutes the majority of at least human suffering, you know, depression, anxiety, meaninglessness, etc.
Yeah, so what do you think the neural or the brain regions that are most correlated with this experience of suffering, such that if, you know, you did a knockout experiment, you know, very surgically, you might be able to get rid of suffering?
It's unclear whether there is a simple area for suffering. I mean, we know you can have a mutation, so there are some rare set of people that have a mutation in a sodium channel,
right,
that leads them not to experience physical pain. Now you would say, wow, they're lucky. They are really the fortunate one. In fact, until recently, until, you know, modern medicine, most of them would die relatively young. They have, they break their bones, they burn, they really suffer a lot from burning because, you know, not even hot water, if they don't feel burning water on their body, they're not gonna, you know, they're not going to immediately withdraw their limbs in the presence of a scalding water. So they suffer. And by the time, so there was a study that was done recently in Pakistan looking at these kids who are adolescent or adult, and they had lots and lots of problems because they don't know when to stop. They don't know when to overextend their bones. They don't know when to overextend their muscle because they don't have any of this feedback. So they don't have some of the basic pain reception that you and I have, and you can definitely see this is dysfunctional, right? This is maladaptive. Yet they still have, of course, I haven't really seen any study, but they clearly are still, of course, can suffer from depression and anxiety and some of these other disorders.
Right. Well, I've seen some case studies, and these kids, I mean, not just the Pakistani ones with the SEN9A gene, if I'm remembering correctly, but they still have psychological, you know, suffering is still in the brain, even if the peripheral transmission of the nociceptive signals don't reach the brain. But I guess I'm wondering, you know, when it gets to the brain, how is it processed? If it can't be localized to a particular area, are there certain areas that are of particular interest to dampening or taking out suffering?
Well, yeah, so we know the physical suffering. So, for example, in volunteers, you can put thermal probes on their body and heat them up a little bit, right, with their permission. And then you can see this activates. So this can generate variable amount of pain until it becomes, you know, unbearable, of course. This activates cortical regions in the secondary somatosensory cortex, right? So that is involved in pain perception. Secondary somatosensory cortex. Higher order pain, if you look at depression, it's very difficult to ascertain. You know, it's both a combination, of course, depression, you have both negative and you have negative symptoms, you can also have positive symptoms. And so a variety of areas, both in the frontal cortex, the cingulate are activated, as well as a variety of subcortical and basal ganglia are disactivated. So it's a really complicated pattern. There isn't one area. If you leave aside physical pain, as far as I know, a lot of that involves higher order somatosensory cortex. We do know, so people who suffer from chronic pain, you can help them by removing the valence by taking out anterior cingulate, either unilateral or bilateral. It's an operation that it's still routinely done today for chronic pain, where you take out this higher order part of the brain in the midline and the front part of the brain of cortex. And people still have whatever caused the chronic pain, but they can still experience it, but it's lost all affect. They simply don't care about it anymore. You can ask them, do you still feel the pain? And the patient will say, yes. Does it bother you? No. So somehow they still feel the physical stimulus somehow, although sometimes it may be phantom pain, which means, you know, it's an absence of a paradoxical and absence of a stimulus, yet it's lost this negative valence by removing this part of the brain.
Yeah, so the cingulate cortex in general is fascinating. When I interviewed David Spiegel, who's at Stanford, he does hypnosis. The area that he said was important for that was the cingulate cortex. And of course, it has many different parts. But who do you think is really kind of like the resident genius in the world on that? Because I'd really like to interview them. If you have anything more to say about the cingulate cortex, that's particularly fascinating.
Yeah, I don't know. I saw a study that fascinated me, but I never saw a follow-up study where they did. So hypnosis, the fascinating thing about it is that it seems to work well in a small subset of people, right? 5% or 7%. And there's nothing particular discerning about those percent. It's not more men than women, or old and young, or educated or not, or religious or not. It's just for some reason, some subset of people are really susceptible to suggestions from others, like the hypnotist, and even the Stroop effect. So the Stroop effect is related. So the Stroop effect is, if I show you, if I ask you to tell me as quickly as possible the color of a word that the word is printed in. If I ask you, I flash up a word, red, and you are supposed to tell me as quickly as possible, red, blue, black. But then I change the font in the color of the font in which the word is printed. So red is now printed in blue, or green is printed in red. Okay. Mm-hmm. Your reaction time will slow down dramatically because now you have this conflict. You see the color red, but it spells out blue. And so this is a conflict. And this Stroop effect is gone in people who are hypnotized. Now, that's very difficult to explain. It's really difficult to explain unless they really, you somehow manage to make him not see the way you and I can see. Anyhow, and in this, the hypnosis seems to involve parts of the anterior cingulate. It's very unclear what it does. And of course, the question is, can you have an experimental model of hypnosis? Can you, for instance, you know, hypnotize a mouse? Or can you hypnotize a monkey, which would give you, which then you could investigate experimentally more at the neuronal level? The really most interesting person to study hypnosis is Wegener at Harvard, who published, wrote this beautiful book, The Illusion of Free Will. And in it, MIT Press, I can warmly recommend it. In it, he has a long section on hypnosis and experiments of hypnosis. I can warmly recommend that book.
Yeah, there's a guy in the UK named John Butler who is a practitioner of this. And if the video is to be believed, he was able to do this on somebody having surgery with no anesthesia whatsoever. And then he had his own surgery. It was a herniorectomy, so it wasn't the most extreme, most invasive surgery that you can have. But he was able to hypnotize himself not to feel any pain, again, without any, as far as I'm aware, exogenous chemicals. So it's absolutely mind-blowing. And it could be that this anterior cingulate region is sort of the interpretive, giving rise to the meaning of the pain. And if the meaning isn't something to worry about, then you could have, in theory, this would be the ideal creature in my mind, a creature that could behave adaptively in the face of threats and damage, but wouldn't necessarily have to feel the raw, nasty side of that experience, the low valence.
Yeah, there is this beautiful scene, this classic scenes in Lawrence of Arabia, you know, with Peter O'Toole, where very mm-hmm. early on in the movie, in when they're in Cairo, before World War One, you know, the character of Lawrence of Arabia puts his hand over a candle, and then his buddy asks him, "How can you do that? It doesn't that mm-hmm. hurt?" And he says, "Yeah, the trick is not minding that it hurts."
Right. Yeah, well, how do you do that? Right. And that's the million-dollar question. I guess I wonder how that's possible. I mean, it would be great if we could figure out how to reproduce that reliably without having to sit on a mountain in Korea for 20 years, you know, in self-isolation, right?
Yes, that may, though, not be possible. But
so, you know, thinking about the future of pain, depression, anxiety, other low valence states, what do you think are the most promising avenues?
yeah, I mean, right now, neuroscience is, you know, if you look at the DSM-5, you know, the standard Bible of psychotherapy and psychologists, there's still not a single biomarker for being sad, right? So neuroscience cannot tell you what sadness is, what the physical correlate, the neuronal correlate of sadness is, or extreme sadness, like in depression, right? I can't even stick you in a magnet and say for certain whether you're depressed or not. I can't do a blood test. I can't do a, you know, an RT-PCR test to find out whether you're depressed. That is the state of the art. It's pretty dismal. Now, people have been doing imaging in anxiety disorders and depression, you know, and they're talking about the nucleus accumbens and prefrontal cortex. But so far, it's all still we still really fundamentally don't know. We know a lot about the epidemiology of these diseases. They have, you know, some genetic component. And so the challenge is to try to find out, given the diversity of causes of these diseases, try to find out at the neuronal level, which you know, fMRI may simply not be good enough, not to, you know, may not have the right level of granularity to find out what are the specific correlates, and then how can I, you know, manipulate those correlates using all sorts of therapies to reduce some of the symptoms. But, you know, look, you know, I'm a neuroscientist now for, you know, almost 40 years. It's been very slow going. Remarkable slow and little progress all in all. Although I know it's not popular to say that.
Well, do you think that the scans, fMRI scans themselves and other scans are just too slow? There may be processes that are happening in the brain that just happen at such an incredibly rapid time scale that we can't pick them up. I mean, for instance, quantum stuff could be going on. What do you think of that?
No, I'm very skeptical about quantum stuff, except, of course, a brain like any other physical organ has to obey quantum mechanics. It's just the level of granularity. The smallest volume that people typically, you know, image or infer something, let's call it a millimeter, right? Let's be generous and say it's a millimeter by millimeter by millimeter. Many scanners, of course, use 2.25 or 2 by 3 millimeter. But let's assume it's a cubic millimeter, right? In that cubic millimeter, they're on the order of 100,000 neurons. They are on the order of a billion synapses. And we now know, partly through the research done at places like the Allen Institute, that in those 100,000 cells are probably of 100 different cell types. So in any particular cortical region, there are roughly 100 different types of cells, half of which are neurons, half of which are non-neurons. The neurons are excitatory inhibitory. Then there are the subclasses, the PV cells, the somatostatin cells, the VIP cells, and then there are again classes under those. There are like 15 different VIP cells and different types of PV cells. And same thing, excitatory cells, the layer 2, 3 pyramidal cell is very different from a layer 5 pyramidal cell. Within layer 5, you have roughly 10 different excitatory cell classes defined by transcriptional means. They project to different parts of the brain. And all of that gets mushed up into the hemodynamic activity that I access using the fMRI. Right? Just because the fMRI is a technique, it's a very safe, it's a reliable technique, so it can reliable measure certain things, you know, blood flow that ultimately has some relationship to the underlying neural activity. So in that sense, it's very lawful and reliable. But the level of granularity is not the level of neurons, right? It's a level of large volumes of brains. Again, let's be generous and say it's at the columnar level, right? If a column, but so it's useful for doing cognitive neuroscience, but it has not proven useful to directly, you know, with high specificity and sensitivity detect whether individual people have a condition or don't have a condition, because it doesn't look at the underlying neurons. And neurons are the atoms of perception, or neurons are the atoms of behavior and disbehavior and dysfunction, like in diseases. So if you don't access those underlying neurons, you're just going to have a very difficult time reliably inferring things about the brain and its conscious experience.
So it's a spatial-temporal problem.
It's a spatial-temporal problem. I mean, it's a spatial-temporal granularity problem. You can use MEG and EG. There, of course, you have much higher temporal resolution, but typically you have much slower spatial resolution. All techniques come with their severe limitations. So we of course record from neurons in animals, or sometimes under rare condition in patients with electrodes, which is cool because now you can hear the chattering of individual neurons. But again, and with modern silicon technology, you can record the activity of 10,000 neurons, right? But even that is a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of all the neurons in your brain. So while microelectrode recording have the relevant temporal level of resolution and can access individual neurons, they only measure a negligible fraction of all neurons at any given time. So that's also very limited. So all these techniques have come with their own limitations.
Yeah, and speaking of techniques for understanding what's happening, what about therapeutic techniques? I'm going to name some, and it would be great if you could tell me how confident you are that they are either therapeutically beneficial now, or they could be in the future because they operate on principles that you think hold water. For instance, vagus nerve stimulation. What do you think of that?
It's a cool thing. We have no idea how it works. None idea whatsoever. Right? We don't even know precisely, you know, its pathways once it goes into the nucleus interpositus.
I know it goes into the medulla.
Yeah, inside the medulla, the specific nucleus, it widely affects many parts of the brain. I mean, if it works, it works. I'm not so, you know, it's great for the clinic, for you know, even with it helps reduce incident of epileptic seizures. So great, use it. But our understanding of it is very, very early, is still very, very immature. But Jake, I don't want to knock the technique. Anything in the clinic that works is great. It's a great discovery and should be used. But that's still a very fast step from trying to understand in a rational, systematic way what are the underlying neuronal actors and how can we best manipulate them. That's still quite a bit away when we're looking at all these techniques, including DBS, you know, one of the more successful ones, deep brain stimulation, right? Used for Parkinson's. Now it's used for reduction of epileptic seizures, right? There's this NeuroPace device. How it works is very, very unclear.
But you're confident that it works well for depression, anxiety?
No, the NeuroPace has been approved by FDA because it seems to work for, it seems to, it's very paradoxical. Long term, chronic electrical stimulation of the brain leads to a reduction of electric seizures. It doesn't make any sense, but it's a fact. Okay, because one might think if I constantly stimulate the brain, shouldn't you constantly get seizures? But you do it at a subclinical level, so you don't get seizures. And somehow that seems to downregulate some mechanisms that we have no idea, that seems to downregulate the overall excitability of the brain.
Any guesses why that happens?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably an adaptive phenomena, right? But what are the specific mechanisms, right? So you constantly have this, the brain perceives there's too much overall electrical activity, in this case caused by the electrical stimulation. And so therefore the brain downregulates itself. It's a rational mechanism. We don't understand all the molecular, and it's not going to be one pathway or one set of neurons like always in the brain. It's probably going to involve, you know, dozens of separate systems. And we can take advantage of that for clinical or for therapeutic purposes. But that still, you know, means we're very far away from understanding rationally how those things work.
Transcranial magnetic stimulation?
Well, again, look, it works. So repetitive TMS is one of the things that works for treatment-resistant depression, right? You've done at least two or three drug therapies. You've been through talk therapy. Nothing works. Then you get your brain zapped, particularly the frontal part of your brain, repetitively, and it seems to work. No idea why, but it seems to work. People clamor to get it because it, just like, remember, EC electroshock therapy. It's still done in some cases when even repetitive TMS doesn't work. People still do electroshock therapy. Now, of course, unlike in the movie, Someone Flew Over a Cuckoo's Nest, you know, you do it with anesthesia, et cetera, so it doesn't give rise to these horrible effects that you saw in that movie. But, you know, why shutting down the brain gets rid of depressions, unclear. But we all know this through our computers. Often we have no idea something is wrong. I just had to do it before, you know, I did this interview with you. Something on the Bluetooth simply wasn't working. I rebooted my computer and le voila, suddenly it was working again, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, do you think that there's something even mysterious about the way that electronics need to be rebooted? I don't know a lot about computer science myself, but what's happening in terms of the physics? Could it be related to what happens in the brain when you reset it, as it were?
No, I think there are just many ways to screw up a system. And so, you know, it's now in some weird state, like my Bluetooth somehow was blocked. And so what you do, you just reset it in its default mode. And by resetting it, you know, whatever weird state it was in just gets flushed out. So I think that may also happen with depression. If you think of depression as being a dysfunctional state of the brain, which obviously it is if you look at the patients and their life. And so totally resetting it, like with electroshock therapy, or maybe in a little bit more mild way using repetitive TMS, seems to reset whatever it was, and they can now get on with their life.
Do you know much about the effect sizes, such that you could give people a sense of how well these work, or maybe you're not familiar enough with each one?
I do know because I work with a psychiatrist. So he says in a subset of people that are treatment resistant, ECT works. There's no question about it. Like always, you don't know ahead of time who responds to it. So not everybody of the treatment resistant patients who have it respond to it. But when they do, it's dramatic. It's not just, you know, it's a 5% effect. It's just the fog is gone. The fog, you know, that descends on their life where everything is meaningless, that suddenly lifts. It's just like in a few set of people have also done this electrical brain stimulation, right? Parts of the infarct, parts of the insula for depression. And there were two large studies that were aborted, unfortunately, because they couldn't find positive effects. But in a subset of patients, it probably has to do where exactly you put the electrode when you stimulate. In a subset of patients, electric brain stimulation in depression seems to work quite dramatically and pretty immediate. that, you know, right there and then people, at least a few subset of patients describe that the fog is lifted. I can see myself clear now. Life is
and
good.
These effects last for a very long time after what, one or a small series of stimulations?
I don't know very long, certainly days. I don't know, again, I don't think those studies have been done where they track those patients for weeks or months. Mm.
Doing anything fancy with like machine learning. I heard about machine learning to help people who had strokes remember more words. And it was pretty shocking to see that, no pun intended, that this helped them learn words much faster, but by using machine learning algorithms and electrodes implanted in the brain.
Yeah, you mean the Eddie Chang work that just came out?
I don't know the author's name, but it sounds like you do.
Yeah, there's this piece of work from UCSF that came out last week. Well, actually, there has been a large DARPA-funded study called RAM, I believe, out of University of Pennsylvania, where they did electrical stimulation in epileptic people, because there they have to already have electrodes to help locate the seizure focus. And there, I think mm-hmm. they try to use machine learning to see whether it leads to enhancement. I don't think those results were very dramatic, though.
Okay. Yeah. What do you think of neurofeedback?
What sort of feedback?
Specifically, the EEG neurofeedback, the stuff that's marketed to people more and seems to be kind of growing in little like private clinics across the country. They put an EEG on somebody's head and they show them some sort of visual representation, and they say that it has benefits for ADHD or even depression.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I did, as an undergrad 40 years ago, I did such an experiment in my university. I volunteered for it. And, you know, yes, there are some effects. Usually the effects are weak. They're not very long lasting. So, you know, if it helps people, great. I'm somewhat skeptical. The effects are relatively small. And, you know, you always have to worry about placebo, of course. So the trouble with EEG is, I mean, this is the trouble with the brain. The real actors are neurons. If you're outside the brain, outside this protective case, outside the skull, right, which is where I want you to keep your stuff, because I don't want your stuff, your electrode, inside my brain. Why? Well, because there's a big risk of infection. There's a risk of bleeding. There's, of course, pain and extremely uncomfortableness to go through the skull. So there's all sorts of reasons why I don't want your tools inside my brain. But if they remain outside the brain, like an fMRI, an EEG, an MEG, they're far away. The signals, the electrical or magnetic effects generated by the brain are relatively weak. So you need fancy tools to get at them. They extend across large areas. So you don't pick up the individual neurons. You pick up the collective activity of everything. How much could we learn about computers if I could only pick up the global activity of billions of transistors, right? So your typical computer has, you know, between 2 and 8 billion transistors, let's say in its CPU. Well, now imagine I put a voltmeter over it and I can only pick up the sort of the aggregate activity, not the individual transistors, but only the switching, you know, at your clock speed of billions of transistors. Well, you average out everything, right? You don't get the individual patterns because you simply don't resolve them. So that's a problem with any of these techniques right now. They're weak and inconsistent effects.
Right. Let's go back to the more theoretical things. Do you think that valence is possible without consciousness?
No, because valence is, there's behavior valence and there's conscious experience valence. So clearly you get in animals and in people, you know, there are certain behaviors that Skinner studied that are reinforced, and there are other behaviors that are discouraged. But ultimately, they rely on pleasure or pain. They rely on positive value, valence, or negative, or low valence, depending on how you, whether, you know, it's negative valence or low valence. So ultimately, it's all about experience. If I don't have an if I don't have a bad experiences, I'm not going to withdraw my hand from that hard plate. That's exactly the point we talked about earlier in those kids that have this mutation in the sodium channel, whereby they don't experience the hot pain of a burning oven plate. And so they keep their hand or their skin there and it burns because they don't realize it until it starts smelling or something. Right. So you need that positive, or in this case, the highly negative valence. Without that, you're not going to get the appropriate rapid withdrawal of behavior.
Often you'll see soldiers. There was a particular story I was watching where a guy got shot in the back of the head and he continued the firefight for another 5 or 10 minutes, completely unaware of his injury. And then, of course, later he felt awful because he had been shot in the head and, you know, he was lucky that it missed vital areas of his brain. So it made me wonder, you know, about things like subconscious pain. And is it possible, in your view, that there could be almost like another version of him trapped inside that does experience anguish, almost like if you had a brain within a brain? But maybe some of these, you know, people laugh at you if you say, well, should we be morally concerned about the enteric nervous system? But what is subconscious pain and is it morally relevant?
I don't know what subconscious pain is. You used that word. I didn't. So it is, as you said, the case of the soldier you just cited. I know this from climbing, from rock climbing. You can see it on the pitch, on the soccer pitch, when people get injured, but they choose not to attend to the injury, so they keep on playing. We can all override, under extreme conditions, override these signals. In the heat of the battle or the heat of the fight, we don't notice it. That's probably, I think what happens there, I'm simply not conscious of the pain because I'm so aroused and I'm so fully engaged and so focused on my goal. You know, I have to engage in this firefight in order to survive that everything else is subservient to that. But I don't think, so I don't believe in subconscious pain. Pain to me is conscious pain. It's really the same. It's like seeing. I can have visual responses that are unconscious, but that's not seeing to me. So it just depends how you define it. So you can have noxious stimuli, right, as this wound clearly must have been, but there wasn't any pain because the soldier didn't perceive it at that point in time. So somehow it got blocked and it wasn't expressed in the right parts of the brain that gave rise to conscious experience. That's what I think happened in that case. And we know this from Buddhists. If you look at those dramatic cases of self-immolation where they burn themselves, mm-hmm. right? So it's just absolutely astonishing how this could happen, right? How I could pour gasoline on my body and calmly light a match to set myself on fire when my entire body must be screaming bloody hell. It's somehow these people sit in lotus seat until they fall over dead and all burn crisp to a tinder. I mean, it's just unimaginable.
Right.
But it's true. I mean, we have this well documented. So certainly either in extreme conditions like in battle or people who have extreme self-control that they acquired through decades worth of in this case, meditation and training, can so control themselves that they don't have the conscious experience. They somehow can suppress the conscious experience of that pain. They somehow don't seem to mind it, in the words of Peter O'Toole playing Lawrence of Arabia. The trick is, and of course this is what Buddhist tells us, the trick is not minding the hurt, not minding the pain, not minding the suffering. Then it doesn't become suffering anymore.
Right. And I think they would avoid using the word suppression, right? Because the point is to be extremely aware of what's happening, but just not to respond to it. Again, do you think that's the cingulate cortex, specifically the anterior cingulate cortex?
Who knows? I mean, it's probably involved, but you know, at this point, it's yes. Let's see. Yes.
Okay. What would the conscious meter that you often talk about show if somebody were under anesthesia but could still feel pain?
Well, then they're clearly conscious. In my book, feeling pain for me is the conscious expression of noxious. It would be in response to noxious stimulus. You can have a noxious. Clearly, you can anesthetize people and you can cut them. Under normal condition, this would cause extreme pain. But on a surgical level of anesthesia, the patient doesn't respond anymore, presumably because they're unconscious. Now, of course, in modern anesthesiological practice, typically they give a cocktail of different agents, including paralyzing agent. So one thing you have to worry about that maybe the patient is just paralyzed, so it's unable to move, but is screaming bloody hell, which is why you need a conscious meter, because you need to be able to tell, is this patient just paralyzed? But really unconscious, but really still conscious. So you really want something that detects the absence of or presence of consciousness in individual subject. And this technique that I sort of describe as conscious meter, it's the more technical term is called Zap or Zip. It requires a transcranial magnetic stimulation and EEG electrode tells you currently this patient either is conscious or is not conscious by the complexity of its brain response. But if the patient's really unconscious, there's no pain perception.
What's morally more important, valence or consciousness?
Oh, ultimately, it's all about consciousness. Valence is one aspect of consciousness. Consciousness to me is any experience, any subjective experience that includes pain and suffering and fear and hurt. But it also includes pleasure. It includes seeing me and being, in love and having an ecstatic experience or tasting a slice of pizza. Those are all different conscious experiences. Valence is a subset, it's like saying color. What's more important, color or consciousness? Color is, for those of us who have color, it's a joyful thing, but it's a subclass of conscious experiences. Or it's an attribute of conscious experience, just like valence is an attribute of conscious experience, positive or negative valence.
Sure, I understand that it's a subset, but do you think it's no more or less morally relevant than, say, what it's like to see the color green?
Well, I guess if you include with valence suffering, which is much more difficult to measure and to describe, right?
Yeah. So, suffering specifically, if you want to exclude positive valence, sure.
Well, what I want to exclude are things that are simply due to physical stimulus, right? So you put a thermal probe on my skin and turn it on, that can hurt because of it causes, high temperature. But then if we're talking about suffering, even particularly in the absence, how somebody can suffer from chronic abuse, how somebody can suffer because they lost their, mother lost her child, a partner, somebody lost their partner. That's ultimately ethical. Any ethical reasoning ultimately has to be about suffering, about, the ability to suffer. And that's why it's important, to come full circle, why I don't eat animals, because I don't want them to, I certainly don't want them to suffer, to be raised under atrocious condition, to be eaten for their flesh. Ultimately, that's all about suffering. So therefore, yes, ultimately you're right. In that sense, suffering is, but suffering is conscious. There is, to me, no unconscious suffering. My fridge, if it doesn't work, my car, if it malfunction, isn't suffering. It's simply malfunctioning. It's not suffering. So suffering always has to be, is, suffering is really conscious suffering. Otherwise, it cannot be suffering.
I've just wondered for myself personally if I should be morally concerned about So I'll tell you a story. When I was a kid, I had this quite scary idea for a very small child to have, which was, well, maybe when I go to sleep, I go to like into a hell world, you know, because I've had nightmares. But what about when I'm not aware, or say I just can't remember what I dreamt the night before? I wonder if, say, one subjects themselves to, like in Lawrence of Arabia, putting their hand over the fire. Now, if that character doesn't report that they were in pain, then, you know, and we don't believe in subconscious pain, then we would say, well, it's not morally important because he somehow overcame that with his, you know, anterior cingulate cortex or whatever means. But I've wondered if I should morally be concerned about, you know, perhaps entities, experiencers that are not accessible to me at a conscious level. And I guess you would say that they don't matter. I think that there's
so they're two separate problems. Yeah. Who has conscious experience, and how do I know they have a conscious experience? That's a separate problem. Yeah, so if somebody, let's say my tree, I'm here on San Juan Island, just south of Vancouver Island, there are all these trees around me. Maybe they're all suffering because they have a blight. You know, there's some insect blight that, okay. So then if they're suffering, that's bad. They're suffering, period. That by itself is, I think, morally bad, even though I may not be able to access it. But that's separate from the question, if they're not conscious, then they're not suffering. To me, that's really as simple as that. Suffering always implies having this horrible experience. If you don't have that horrible experience, there is no suffering.
Thought experiment, somewhat similar to Craig Venter and other people had, of creating the most genomically simple organism, right? You have the fewest base pairs to create an organism that can replicate and do the other qualifications that make it count as life. If you could create a creature that, you know, doesn't have rich experiences like multiple foveas in a falcon, allowing it to have incredible eyesight, but it was just the absolute minimal amount of experience, and the only experience it had was either feeling good or bad. How does that change the landscape?
Well, if it feels good or bad, then it does have some capability. It may be very primitive, but it does have some capability about suffering.
And if suddenly it gained the ability to smell like a dog, that probably wouldn't be morally important.
It may be less important, but I'm not sure to what extent. To what extent you can weigh. Look, suffering is bad. I think it's bad in some absolute sense.
Right.
I don't know directly how to weigh that against seeing or smelling or hearing. You know, those are all different senses. I certainly would suffer if I now, having grown up and having lived my entire life with a sense of hearing or seeing, if I would lose that sense, it would certainly make me suffer to a certain extent. So in that sense, it's bad. In some absolute sense, you could also say that the more a creature can, the more diverse its sensorium, the more it can learn about the external world. In some sense, I would say that that's a positive goal, to appreciate, you know, to more and more appreciate, to better and better understand what life is all about. I do think that's one of the goals we're all called upon, to understand the universe and our place in it. And therefore, the better I can understand it, the better it is for me. And I can understand it, the more senses I have. And so in that sense, for me, one of the ultimate goals is for me to understand the universe and my place in it. And for that, I need different senses.
But the reason that you like that is because you get a valence boost whenever you understand the world in a more intricate way. Even, you know, having the perception that it's beautiful to understand more requires you to have this valence sensor, right?
So it's not just about the valence. It's about, I mean, I think Buddhism teaches us this. It's not just the absence of any feeling, or the presence of one particular feeling, but it's this incredible richness. Now you can of course take that to the meta level and say, okay, whatever criteria you have for understanding. Right. Maybe that's just another way of looking at valence. I don't know.
Thanks for tuning in today. Dr. Koch has expressed an interest in coming on again to talk about other topics like integrated information theory. If you have questions for him or us, go ahead and let us know.